Welcome to the Kindlings Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Welcome, everybody. This is Dick Staub, your host. Thanks for joining us tonight. We've got a great show ahead of us talking about a subject that many of us really enjoy talking about, the whole world of film. Media consultant Michael Wolff once said in The New Yorker, "I really believe entertainment in a lot of ways has become a way for people to come together. It has, in fact, I'm convinced of this, it's become a replacement for religion. In the same way people used to quote scripture, they're now quoting Seinfeld." It's so weird that I should be quoting that, because just yesterday, sitting at lunch in New York, I heard these two young guys talking about their favorite episode of Seinfeld. And this great sense of sentimentality around, oh yeah, that was a great episode, do you remember? Catholic sociologist Andrew Greeley goes even further than Michael Wolff, saying that popular culture is not just a source of dialogue about ideas conveyed through popular culture stories and characters, but it's actually a place where God shows up. He says, my thesis is simple enough. Popular culture is a theological place. It's the locale in which one may encounter God. Popular culture provides an opportunity to experience God, to tell stories about God, to put the matter more abstractly, to learn about God, and to teach about God. In Real Spirituality, Robert Johnson from Fuller Seminary says that there's been a progression from identifying popular culture as a place about God to the other end of the spectrum, which is to call film a God place. He says spiritual seekers, whether irreligious or religious, consider movies and music to be places to encounter the transcendent, to meet God, to do theology. Every week, newly released songs, films, or books give voice to our common human concerns and probe the essential human questions. Who is God? Who are we as humans? What is our meaning and identity? What are our essential problems? Is there a hope and a future? As a matter of fact, for a lot of people, particularly in the younger generation, there's a sense that these questions, once the domain of church and organized religion, are actually addressed more actively and regularly and honestly in the cultural discussion than in the church. Well, tonight we're going to discuss the theology, the beliefs, the values of five films nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. The films were Babel, The Departed, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen. And we're going to enjoy a conversation with a distinguished panel, and then in a few minutes we're going to get a chance to talk with our live audience. And as always, those of you that are listening by podcast or reading this online can post your comments at thekindlings.com. Our panel tonight includes Jeffrey Overstreet, a prolific film critic and author of Through a Screen Darkly, and there are copies of that book here tonight, and you can pick up a copy before you leave if you'd like. Stefan Olstein is with us. He's also a film critic and educator and the author of a book titled Growing Up Fundamentalist, which is how I first met Stefan. A lot of people that I've most come to enjoy over the years are people that I met through interviewing them about their books first. And then Jenny Spohr, who's yet to write her first book, but I somehow met her anyway, is the producer of The Kindlings Muse, and she also has been involved in making film and in studying film and theology at Fuller Seminary. So, it's great to have all of you guys with us tonight. And real quickly, were you happy with the results last night? Was there anything that you were bothered by? Any film that you thought was sadly overlooked?
I was happy that it was the fastest moving, most entertaining, light on its feet Oscars I think I've ever seen, just aside from the whole awards question. It was nice that it wasn't boring. Even the speeches were meaningful quite a bit of the time. But to get to a very technical part of filmmaking, I was there to see Children of Men win Best Cinematography. And it didn't. What were they? I mean, in 25 years, they will be looking at what happened with, what they did with the camera in that film. And they'll be going, how did they do that? And it's, you know, time will be the better judge than the Oscars in that one, I think.
Okay. Any other comments from you guys?
I was disappointed that Babel didn't win and didn't get more recognition last night. I thought The Departed was a great movie, and we'll talk about both of these more tonight, but I just thought Babel deserved to have some recognition for what it did. It took some very divergent stories and put them together in a way we'll talk about further, but was intriguing, innovative, I think, for film, especially a film on that stage, and I was sad to see it and not get recognized for anything other than, what was it, art direction? No, it wasn't even art direction, something.
Soundtrack,
which was very good and worked really well with the film, but to have it nominated for so many things, along with a lot of other Latin films, and to not see much recognition last night of those films was disappointing to
me. How about you, Stefan?
I really wanted Adriana Barraza or Rinko Kikuchi to get Best Supporting Actress. I thought Adriana just carried this picaresque performance flawlessly through. And Kikuchi, I just thought, you know, in just a very short time, she just had such a tremendous impact. As, you know, it's one of the most concise performances I've seen.
It was, people were talking about this as the international Oscars because there were more international films, and three Mexican filmmakers had major films this year. And ultimately, now this morning, the headlines are, you know, America fights back. You know, Scorsese finally gets his Academy Award. Do you think that the international films were dealt a fair hand in the process? Obviously, Jeffrey, you, Children of Men, you're already stating.
Well, the Oscars are so inclined against international films to begin with. I mean, each country gets to submit one movie to be considered. I mean, give me a break. That means if the 10 best movies came out of France, they would still have to only submit one, and we would only end up hearing about it, and it might not even win. I mean, how American?
Yeah, exactly. Well, if Bill Hogg was here, he'd be talking about the World Series of baseball. That's all American teams.
Of course.
You know, there is a little bit of a provincialism in now we're going to decide what the best movies are. And you other countries, you get to each submit one.
Well, I remember that Michael Medved wrote a column that was published in USA Today a couple of years ago, 3 years ago now, I think, where he said that critics' top 10 lists at the end of the year are full of titles of movies that we've never heard of. And that's how critics make themselves feel like they're serving an important role by telling you about a whole bunch of things you haven't heard of. And frankly, I'm thinking, no, it's that the critics get to see films from other countries.
Yeah.
They're not distributed here. And we get to see all this great stuff. And how do we show it to our friends? You know, you have to wait for the DVD, which might be two or 3 years.
I saw that column, and I thought it was, you know, it's a little bit like a food critic wouldn't go on and give you a great review about McDonald's, even though that's where everybody eats. And I thought that was a little facetious, really.
Yeah, am I being just elitist if I recommend a Thai restaurant?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of sad.
So the whole thesis that I started with tonight, that that film is a place where God shows up and where theology is done, I think you all agree or at least have a sense of that being the case. But how did you first become aware of that? How did that become kind of a way that you began to look at film?
Well, mine was through a guy named Al Greeno. I don't think he's seen a movie for 30 years. But he taught, you know, that everything can be seen from a Christian perspective. And what that is you don't see a Christian perspective as a different paradigm. You look at everything you would look at, but then using that as a raw material, you say, now, how as a Christian do I see this? So in Babel, for instance, you know, you look at a great story and great characters, and you look at the sound, and you look at the locations and everything. But then as a Christian, you say, you know, what are these people looking for? What kind of redemption are they trying to find?
Mine actually started when I started learning how to make films. I didn't really make the connection between film and God and my spirituality. I kind of had a truncated view of what your spiritual life is and what it means to be a Christian in the world. And it wasn't until I started making film and realizing what is in my head is going to come out on a screen and people are going to watch it and they're going to have the exact reaction I want them to have, hopefully, when they see that. I realized the power that's in that and realized this is the exact same thing I do when I write a sermon.
You need to write a book.
Thanks.
You know, we'd read it, but yeah. For me, it was what the movies taught me that God was there, in spite of what my fellow Christians were telling me. But you know, everybody got excited about Chariots of Fire because you know I was I think 10 when it came out. But here was a Christian character preaching the gospel. The church could get behind this movie. But what was the lesson? That he didn't have to go on the mission field and preach to be glorifying God. He could glorify God through creativity and excellence. And his father's words are still ringing in my ears. You can glorify God by peeling a potato if you peel it to perfection. And that meant that excellence in any kind of movie was glorifying God. Then came Amadeus, where I learned that, and it doesn't take a Christian to reveal the truth in art. Here are these sophisticated, pious, self-righteous musicians, and they're all infuriated that this rowdy, womanizing, foul-mouthed, bawdy idiot could tear back the veil and show them the glory of God. And that told me that I might even find God against his best efforts in a Woody Allen movie. So,
are what the three of you describing, is it a peculiarly conservative Christian Protestant issue? Or because if you look at Catholics, I don't think people that have been raised in Catholicism have ever had this pressing question about whether God would show up in film or in fiction. And
well, the Catholic League for Decency or something was pretty strict about what you couldn't see.
Yeah, but that was a conservative movement within Catholicism. I mean, mainline Catholic theology had a place for film, and the decency groups were basically about moral issues, language and nudity. But the idea that you could tell stories about humans and that that would be an exercise of glorifying God didn't seem to be as much of a problem within other traditions.
Certainly in the Jewish tradition as well as the tradition of storytelling, and many Jews in Hollywood make amazing films that are deeply theological, whether they want them to be or not,
right.
Because I think they're brought up in storytelling and that these are things that come together
but
for them.
I mean, of course, Jesus was Jewish, but he's also the origin of Christian, theology, and story should have been part of the Christian unfolding of what it means to be human and the importance of it. And it's one of the great ironies that conservative Christian fundamentalism wants film to stop doing what the Bible does, which is tell the truth about the human condition.
And yet Christ's own parables, he refuses to tell you what the point of the story is. He wants you to wrestle with it and make it your own, and figure out what's going on. And that's why we're still wringing out those parables for every last drop of meaning, because there's so much going on in there. Because he said, to those who have ears to hear, let them hear.
Yeah,
I think the Protestantism in reaction to Catholicism was trying to get away from the abuse of the idea of icons. They wanted everything boiled down to simple scripture, and in reaction to the Enlightenment, we decided to stoop to the level of the Enlightenment and argue on purely rational grounds, and everything became about a message. We wanted to tell stories that handed you the moral of the story at the end, so you would get it.
Right.
And we lost the idea that incarnation speaks in ways that words can't, and that a picture speaks in a way that words can't. Creation pours forth speech, we're told.
Right.
And I think we lost track of how to read symbol, how to read mystery, how to read art. And we're just now starting to get it. Oh, excellence, beauty. This actually says something. It means something.
And it is still true, though, that even people who have moved to the place where they're willing to accept that film tells story are often still looking for very specific words. They want to study the script to get whether there's anything religious or theological or godlike going on, which is why of the five films that we talk about tonight, the easiest one for most religious folks to say, well, that's got godlike stuff in it, is Babel. Because I remember when I saw Babel and I walked out and I heard a bunch of people, trying to explain to their friends that Babel's in the Bible. This, of course, is Seattle, and so we have a good deal of illiteracy about kind of biblical story. But I remember hearing people, explaining, and I was really fascinated with how good a job they were doing, describing the chapter in Genesis where this tower was built and what it meant. And I was mentioning to you guys earlier that A.O. Scott, great film critic in the New York Times, starts with this paragraph, which almost sounds like it could have been out of a religious magazine. The biblical story of Babel takes up a handful of verses in the 11th chapter of Genesis, and it illustrates, among other things, the terrible consequences of unchecked ambition. As punishment for trying to build a tower that would reach the heavens, the human race was scattered over the face of the earth in a state of confusion, divided, dislocated, and unable to communicate, more or less as we find ourselves today. I mean, but that's kind of easy because the text gets at the text.
But, you know, some people would look at it differently. To a lot of people, Babel, you know, refers to confusion. You know, he confused their tongues. And if you came in with the idea that it's confusion, you could also look at it as chaos theory, where some little thing happens, you know, a guy gives somebody a gun, and then it completely unfolds for no reason. And that's why I think film is good. You can talk to somebody who sees it that way, and you can say, well, I think, you know, I see it this way, but I can see your point. But that's what I like about that film, is you could take it from a number of ways.
Well, let's talk about Babel. I mean, when you think about asking big questions and getting at big questions and mystery and the human condition and the question of whether we have hope or not, what are some of the things that you would want to comment on in Babel when you do a theology of Babel?
It was interesting that you both brought that Babel up, what that's about. The theme that kept hitting me as I was watching the movie was so that they will not understand each other. We will spread them. And so you've got these different stories of people literally spread all over the world who do not understand each other, who are desperately seeking to be understood, desperately seeking to have connection with each other, and yet don't even see how connected that they are.
Yeah, I think the question I come away with is, what do these stories have to do with one another? And they're all, strangely enough, the same story. Probably the simplest distillation of what the film is about is the story of the deaf girl who just can't connect and is trying and trying, and all she's left with is exploiting herself. And we see a breakdown in her relationship with her father, with her relationship with other men, with her relationship with friends. And then you start looking at the other stories and you say, oh, the husband and the wife are talking past each other. The parents and the kids are talking past each other. The media and the audience are clearly talking past each other. And the government, oh dear. But with a title like Babel, you would think that eventually there would be something steering us in the direction of, well, what is this? What does this say about God? And all I really found in that, at least the first time I saw it, was the moment when Brad Pitt's character turns and watches this Muslim man praying and looks at this as if he's never seen it before. Like, what exactly is going on here? And I asked Inarritu about this when he came to Seattle. I said, is that your hint? You know, is you gave us a biblical title, you gave us a man praying. What are you saying about God? And he said, well, I grew up Catholic, and I believe a lot of that stuff, he said, but I think at this point God's just kind of stepping back, and it's up to us to start loving our families and repairing things on the family level. The movie is all about family, every single story. And while it's interesting because it's very similar to what Alfonso Cuarón said about Children of Men, which we might talk about that later, but they're both saying, you know, God has every right to give up on us, and we shouldn't worry about putting our hope in God because we've just, you know, ruined it, and it's up to us now to fix it.
It's interesting, though, that this was a story by a Mexican filmmaker, not by an American filmmaker. And if you look at all the issues about immigration, you look at the relationship between Mexico and the United States, this is a story about people who don't understand each other because they can't understand the language that each is speaking, and it is if they are deaf. To me, the deaf girl scene was most powerful too, and particularly when she goes in the disco and the filmmaker has it go completely silent. And so you're walking in and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I've never once asked, how does a deaf person dance? How do you know what the beat is? How do you know what the sound is? You can't hear the sound of the music. And that's so powerful around this problem of human disconnection, because we can't hear each other's music. We don't know what each other is saying. That's one of the things that I find most distasteful about the concept of a culture war, is that we have a built-in metaphor that says not only do we not listen to each other, but we don't want to listen to each other because we're at war. And it's this weekend I had the experience again of of trying to draw people into conversation who don't usually talk with each other, and finding that there can be a fruitfulness to that if we would understand each other. Now, I think Babel was a fantastic exploration of the disconnection of the human race. But theologically, might people look at the story in the Bible and say the point was to confuse them so they wouldn't understand each other? And wouldn't one say, what kind of a God is that? It's God's fault that we can't understand each other. God gave us different languages and scattered us. Why wouldn't God want us to understand each other? I thought this thing was about, you know, we're all made in his image and we should learn to, you know, love each other. And what's going on there?
Well, that's a good question. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that is interesting in the whole story is that we all got together and we're building this big tower to become God ourselves. Again, don't we always do that? I mean, looking throughout the Bible, that's what we're always trying to do. So God scattering us, I don't think the intent theologically is for us not to connect on a human level. We're made for a relationship in the first chapter of Genesis. That's obvious that we're made for a relationship with God and with each other and with the created world. So I don't think theologically you can make that argument that God scattered us so we're not going to understand each other. So that's okay. It's God's fault. No, we should strive to connectedness, but we shouldn't strive to be our own gods.
But, yeah.
You know, you could look at it a different way, too. Throughout that film, it's assumed that everybody speaks English. You know, he goes to Morocco and says, you know, I'm going to speak to you in English. He's expecting his Mexican maid to speak in English. And in a sense, there's this terrific arrogance. You know, he expects Morocco to stop for his wife. He expects his maid to not go to her son's wedding. He expects everything to stop. You know, and if you think about, you know, Americans speaking English around the world and also having that arrogance of saying, you also have to stop your country for me. You know, in a sense, you can see where God was going with that.
Well, the whole thing about not speaking language is that it tends to breed fear and distrust. And one of our visitors tonight has taught in Morocco, and he was pointing out to me that it was implausible that there would be guns everywhere in Morocco because Moroccans don't have guns. But remember that the tourists, the Australian tourist, was afraid in the village because he thought they were all terrorists. Because obviously they're not Americans, so they must be terrorists. So I'm not saying this is an anti-American thing, because I think actually the filmmaker did a good job of showing that whether you're in Japan or wherever you are, these kinds of disconnects happen. But it certainly got to that point. Well, we're going to pick up there when we come back, talk about some more of the Best Picture nominees and, of course, the Best Picture winner. Coming up right after this, you're listening to The Kindling's Muse, and, of course, we'll get to our audience questions as well. Don't go away. Thank you for listening to The Kindling's Muse. If this program sparks something in you, I invite you to participate at www.thekindlings.com. That's K-I-N-D-L-I-N-G-S. Share this program, tell a friend, or just leave a comment at www.thekindlings.com.